Okay. So, yeah, so that's roughly right. So I think we have up to paragraph 120, I think it is. So we're kind of in the middle of this discourse. So, okay, so let's get started. So this is, again, the very famous Mahaparinibbana Sutta that we're looking at. And it's very interesting because it has so many different facets to it. Lots of Dhamma content, of course. Lots of historical content, the story of the Buddha's passing away. And for this reason, it's very interesting and full of little fascinating details. And of course, a lot of interesting Dhamma stuff at the same time. So we have just been looking at how the Buddha started out in Rajagaha at the very beginning, and he sets out from Rajagaha on his last journey before his final passing away at Kusinara, maybe 6 months or so afterwards, after his leaving from Rajagaha. So he's traveling north, and we have seen him just now at the last time. He was at Nalanda, which is now, of course, the site of the famous ruins of the ancient Nalanda University. And there are Nalanda universities being built right now around the world. People are still kind of excited by the idea of universities. I'm not sure myself whether that's the best way of kind of spreading Buddhism, to do it through universities. But anyway, that seems to be, people seem to like academia, academic things. I guess they feel a certain trust that academic research will maybe give some kind of impartial and good results, perhaps. But of course, it loses out on the main point of Buddhist practice, which is to practice these teachings rather than just research them. Anyway, so then the Buddha sets out from Nalanda and it goes to Patalikama. And this is the little village at the time of the Buddha. And this little village later on expands and becomes the center, the core of the Magadhan Empire, becomes known as Pataliputta. And in the present day, this city, of course, still exists. And in the present day, it's called Patna. And if you go to India, there's a museum there with some of the Buddha relics and some of the ancient kind of remnants of Pataliputra, what it was like at the time, not of the Buddha, but after the time of the Buddha, when it was the capital of the Shokan Empire. Those remnants can still be found and have been excavated through archaeological research. In the last century or so, you found some massive wooden pillars that must have probably belonged to the Ashokan palace and that sort of thing. Yeah. So the excavations there, they fit fairly well with how the sutras explain these things, and also other accounts from other historical personages, such as the Greek ambassador to Pataliputra called Megasthenes. He was there. He described the magnificence of Pataliputra as well. And that was about 300 BC. So this was before even Ashoka became the emperor of Magadha. So now we have come to Pataliputra. And these are the what happens now is what the incidents that happened when the Buddha came there. This is what is going on now. And as always, I find it interesting to read this sort of discourse and to compare it to the historical facts that we have and see how the suttas actually often fit very well with the historical facts, how it kind of fits into the flow of history fairly nicely. And this is also the case for Pataliputra, in this case Pataligama. So, it says here, and as always, if you have any questions, please just ask at any time as we go along. And it says, and having stayed at Nalanda as long as he wished, the Lord said to Ananda, let us go to Pataligama. And they did so. At Pataligama, they heard the Lord has arrived. And the lay followers of Pataligama came to the Lord, saluted him, sat down to one side and said, may the Lord consent to stay at our rest house. And the Lord consented by silence. So here we have a kind of typical standard passages. It says there they saluted the Lord. I think salute is maybe not exactly all that precise. It's more like you bow down. probably what it means there. And then he sat down to one side. Abhivadeti is the Pali word behind this. And then they asked him to come and stay at their rest house, the Avasata Gara. This is in the Pali language. And this was one of the things that people would do in those days. If they built a new rest house, they would get some kind of auspicious person to come and stay there first of all. Yeah, the Buddha, or maybe some other spiritual leader, if they had faith in some other religion apart from the Buddhist one. Huh? Yeah, and then I guess what happens is that everybody feels better, I suppose. You have a spiritual person coming to stay at your house, you feel probably a bit protected. Yeah, and I think that maybe what we have today, when you invite people, you have a new house and you invite maybe a monk or a nun or someone to your house, is quite common in Buddhism. It's probably a similar thing that we see here. You invite them and then it feels better afterwards. You feel more protected. We have somebody in our house to kind of bless it or whatever. Does it work? It probably does, because if you feel good about something, if you feel happy about something, usually that tends to have an effect on the household, if you have a positive kind of psychological feel about things. So probably has some impact in one way or another. And then the Lord consented by silence, which is the standard way for the Buddha to consent to things. Understanding his consent, they rose from their seats, saluted the Lord, or bowed down to the Lord, and passing him by to the right, they went to the rest house and strewed the floor, prepared seats, prepared a water pot, and filled the oil lamp. Then they went to the Lord, saluted him, stood to one side, and said, "It is ready at the rest house, Lord, and now is the time to do as the Lord wishes." So this is kind of fairly standard passage that we find in the suttas. It's a little bit strange, the passing him by to the right. What this probably means is that they circumambulated him, keeping the right side towards him. Same thing that we have now. When you see monks, you always have one shoulder bare. And this is a kind of a sign of respect when you have one shoulder bare, the right shoulder bare. And in the same way, when you by keeping the right side towards somebody, that is a sign of respect in ancient India, and it is today still in Buddhist countries. As a monk, if I come into a hall like this, I will always put my robe on one shoulder first of all, and then you bow down to the Buddha. If you have your robe on two shoulders, you don't normally bow down, because it's not a respectful way of dressing if you have it on both shoulders. So this goes all the way back to this time. You would then circumambulate the Buddha, keeping the right side towards him, and then go around. It's interesting how some of these very ancient traditions are still fully alive today. You can see how we have taken many of these ancient traditions straight from the time of the Buddha. And some of them may actually go back beyond the Buddha as well, into even a deeper part of Indian history. But we're still today basically doing many of the same things. And it always surprises me. I often find little details in the suttas, and you recognize this as practices that still carry on in the present day. So people have really been kind of picking out little bits in the suttas and kind of, trying to do things exactly in the right way. That's how it seems sometimes. So they strewed the floor. It just means that they prepared mats on the floor, something like that, providing a water pot, and that is for washing your feet. And of course, in ancient India, people would often go barefoot, and because of that, washing your feet was always a requirement before you entered any building or entered any area at all. Then they go to the Lord. Here, the Bhagava is the Pali word, and Lord, I think, is not a bad translation. Then said, "All is ready, please come at your own convenience," etc. The Lord dressed, in other words, he robed up. He put his robe over two shoulders. That's really what it means. It doesn't mean that you dress everything. You put your robe in the right way, and together with your took his robe and bowl and went with his monks to the rest house, where he washed his feet, went in, sat down facing east, with his back against the central pillar. And the monks, having washed their feet, went in and sat down with their backs to the west wall facing east, with the Lord sitting in front of them. And the lay followers of Padaligama, having washed their feet, went in, sat down with their backs to the eastern wall facing west, with the Lord before them. So here again you have some of these little peculiarities. You have this idea that first of all they're all washing their feet. Interesting here to note that the Buddha seems to be washing his own feet. It's fairly humble in a sense. It's not some, you know, these days it's very common, even if you're just an ordinary monk, sometimes people wash your feet for you. But the Buddha washed his feet, so his own feet. So you wonder what sometimes we look after some monks today better than we looked after the Buddha in those days, which is kind of interesting here. Then he went in facing east, and this is, I'm not sure exactly why he is facing east. I'm not sure what that is, and must maybe some ancient Indian tradition perhaps again, not sure. But what I do know is that if you go to Buddhist monastery in the present day, you will often find that the Buddha statue is placed in precisely that position, facing east. Yeah? Not here, are we facing east? Oh, I have no idea which way is it? East is this way, is it? So not really facing east then, we have to face that way. Okay, so maybe we have to rebuild the hall, tear it down, rebuild it, build it up again, face the right direction. So you can see how these little details have been taken out of the suttas and used in this way. And then he sits down against the pillar, and then, of course, with the people around him. Then the Lord addressed the lay followers of Patalikama, householders. There are these five perils to one of bad morality, one of failure in morality here. So it's a kind of standard sutta topic that the Buddha would often use to lay people, of course to monks as well, but to lay people it was often these kind of suttas that you would see in the Suttapitaka. Fairly basic, straightforward things about morality and that sort of thing. And this may very well have been the Buddha's first visit to Patalikama. There is no other instance in the suttas of the Buddha visiting this place. So because it was the first instance, there may have been people who were new to Buddhism, and then you kind of start them off in a nice way. And this particular sutta is the particular five things that we're going to see now. They are very kind of ordinary, straightforward thing that most people can understand. So what are these five? In the first place, he suffers great loss of property through neglecting his affairs, it says here. In the second place, he gets a bad reputation. For one who is immoral, there is bad reputation. In the third place, whatever assembly he approaches, whether Kattiyas, Brahmins, householders, or ascetics, he does so diffidently and shyly. In the fourth place, he dies confused. In the fifth place, after death, at the breakup of the body, he arises in a bad state, a bad fate, in suffering, or even in hell. These are the five perils to one of bad morality. So these are fairly straightforward things. The only one which is perhaps, you know, people wouldn't really not be able to appreciate straight away is the idea of being reborn in a bad destination. But this was probably a very common view in India at that time, the idea of rebirth. So people would probably, not many people would accept that without further questioning probably. But the first one here is you suffer great loss of property through neglecting his affairs. Now, first of all, there is no word, affairs doesn't actually occur in the Pali at all. So I don't really know why Maurice Walsh has added that in there. Sometimes these things happen, they add things which doesn't really belong. This is the nice thing of having a laptop, you can actually get the Pali and everything up. It's really, really handy here. Yeah, so all it says is that it, because of tamada, because of negligence, or because of heedlessness. Heedlessness is a very nice translation for pamada, right? Because of heedlessness, you lose a great amount of wealth. That is what it's saying here. So it's interesting. What does immorality have to do with heedlessness? What is the connection here? Why is there one thing? And it seems kind of slightly random. Immorality leads to loss of wealth through heedlessness. I think that an immoral person is largely a person who is heedless about how the world functions, how they function, about the effect of morality in a person's life. Yeah, anyone who reflects carefully about morality and about its effect on one's personal well-being, psychology, and all of these things, we recognize that there is a very close connection between our personal well-being and how we live our lives, whether we are moral or not. And it's this idea of being heedless which blocks you from seeing that. Heedless means that you are not careful. You don't consider things properly. You don't think about things carefully. Yeah, it's what heedless basically is. And because you don't consider things properly, because you're kind of, you know, too scattered or too much craving and running around, kind of getting all things sorted out, because of that, you become generally heedless. And because you are generally heedless, it means that you also lose your wealth, because it affects all your affairs, not just your morality. It affects everything, not just your morality. Everything is affected by heedlessness. And interesting, you know, you would have thought maybe the Buddha would have used kamma as an example. Yeah, you lose wealth because you're making bad kamma. But no, it doesn't seem to be the main thing here. It's not so much about bad kamma. It's about heedlessness instead. Bad kamma in this life is not, bad kamma in terms of loss of property will maybe function more across lifetimes. But in this life, you probably have enough good karma already from the past to sustain your property, whatever it is, but you lose it through heedlessness instead. And of course, it is something that people can relate to much better. Yeah, it's something that people can understand straight away. Whereas karma is often much more imponderable because it has to do with rebirth and all these kind of things. So fascinating. Just by being heedful, yeah, just by being careful, by considering properly, reflecting properly, all of these good things happen as a consequence. One of the things that you see when you look at the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya and other places, and you see some of the very basic things that are essential for anything in Buddhism, any kind of person to flourish in the Buddhist teachings. One of those very basic things is precisely appamada, which is the opposite of the word here. This is pamada, which is like heedlessness. Appamada is heedfulness. And it's one of those very foundational things at the very beginning. And if you haven't got that, you don't even get started with anything here. Because if you don't have some kind of care in how you live your life, in how you choose your friends, to make sure that you have kalyanamittas, rather than, you know, the opposite of kalyanamitta? Opposite of kalyanamitta? Papamitta. Papa, the evil friends, yeah? So you make sure that you have the good friends rather than the bad friends, rather than the evil ones. So the very basic things like that, if you don't have that, there is no hope really. There is no starting point. Everything kind of goes awry. And the same thing here is true for property. It's a very foundational part of the Buddhist path. There's another nice sutta which talks about, which maybe we should do here one day. So maybe in 2025, when we get finished with the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, we can have a look at this sutta. It's going to be way down the line sometime. But that sutta has factors, three and three and three factors. Yeah, sets of threes. And at the very beginning of those three factors, it starts off with, I think, appamada and hiri and otapa. Yeah, so hiri and otapa goes together with appamada. Hiri means like shame. You have a sense of shame when you do bad things. You do something bad, you don't want to tell your mates straight away, oh, I did bad. Actually, you want to hide it a little bit. That's what shame is all about, yeah? And otapa is a fear of the consequences. You know it's going to have bad consequences. So these are kind of sort of the root, really root things on the Buddhist path. So careful reflection, careful consideration, so important in Buddhism. Also how we look at the suttas, reflecting on the suttas, right, in all of this. In the second place, you get a bad reputation if you are immoral. The Pali says, for one who is immoral, there is a bad reputation, quite literally here. Yeah, so you get a bad reputation if you are immoral. And of course, the people that you really get a bad reputation among is the people who matter in this world. Those other people who are wise, who are moral, who are kind, they're not going to be so interested in hanging out with you if you're immoral. One of the interesting things in the suttas is that the Buddha says that we tend to hang out with people who are like us. Yeah. So if you are moral, you want to be with other moral people. You don't want to be with all the scallywags in the world. Yeah. If your meditation is going well, you'd like to hang out with other people who meditate well because it feels right. Yeah. You have roughly the same kind of purity of mind. You meet together, you meditate together, and you know, you're doing the same thing. You discuss the same things. Your interests are the same things. If you have a degree of wisdom, you hang out with other people of wisdom. If you are bad, evil-minded person, you'd like to hang out with similar kind of people. So we tend to be with other people who are like that. So for this reason, if you are moral, you will be praised by other people who are moral in the world, other people who got the act together. And that's what is nice. Yeah, it's nice to be praised by those who are wise. And it doesn't really matter what everyone else thinks, as long as we're praised by the wise people. And there is a nice sutta, this is also in the Anguttara Nikaya, what the Buddha says that talks about the different scents, the scents of flowers, yeah, the odor of flowers, etc. And he talks about various kinds of scents. And it says, well, the scents of flowers, etc., they always only goes with the wind. There's only one scent that goes against the wind, and that is the scent of virtue or the scent of morality. Yeah. It spreads to all directions, regardless of the wind. Yeah, everybody eventually gets to hear about it when someone is good. So that's why the Buddha, one of the reasons why the Buddha is so famous, I think, and many other people like, in history, like maybe Gandhi is one of the kind of more modern examples. And maybe Ajahn Brahm, yeah, he's pretty famous now. He's also probably for the similar kind of reasons. So you get a good reputation. You can see here that these are fairly worldly things, yeah? The Buddha is talking to ordinary people that may not be Buddhists, so they can understand what is going on, understand the basic benefits of morality. Yeah. And in a third place, whatever assembly you approach, whether Khatriyas is one of the four castes in ancient India, the Kshatriyas in Sanskrit, are like the aristocrats, yeah? The rulers of society, etc. And then we have the Brahmins, which are the priestly caste. And then we have the householders and ascetics. These are the kind of the main assemblies, the main kind of groupings of people. And when you go to these assemblies, you are confident. Yeah, you're not shy. You don't feel kind of slightly ashamed of yourself, anything like that. And this is kind of one of those nice benefits of morality. It's not people who are, are immoral. They very often feel, I guess, a sense of maybe shame, a sense they're not really worthy of sitting in front in an assembly and kind of speaking up or whatever. They feel slightly unworthy because they know in their heart that they haven't really lived well. So, and the opposite, if you live well, you tend to feel confident about yourself because you know I'm living well. You know that you're doing the right thing. You know that you are already supporting others. You know that your intention is good. And because you know that it's reasonable for you to be able to speak up in that sort of situation as well. Monks will often kind of, give the five precepts to people. Yeah, every Sunday, the weekend, we do that here. Why is it that as a monk, we do this? How come not somebody else does it? And the reason, of course, is that if you keep an even higher degree of morality yourself, that gives you the authority to give the eight precepts or five precepts to others. that authority comes from your own moral conduct. And if you don't live a moral life, then you also lose that authority, so to speak. People won't listen to you anymore. They won't be interested. Yeah, you're not going to take the five precepts from a scallywag who doesn't keep any precepts. It doesn't make any sense, yeah? Straight away, you feel it's like a fraud. What on earth is this person doing, kind of dispensing the precepts to others when they are such a bad person themselves? In the same way, authority, even in worldly matters, comes from a sense of morality and living well. I think it's so important that we have leaders who are moral in this world. It really matters enormously. And I think we really tend to respect people so much more when they live well in this way. Anyway, so you feel confident when you go to the assemblies. In the fourth place, you die confused. So when you are immoral, you come to your deathbed, you are samulho, you are confused. So is that a good idea to be confused when you die? Probably not, right? Probably not a good idea at all. Imagine you coming to your deathbed, you are there, you are lying down, and when you die, you want to die peacefully, you want to die mindfully, ideally. You don't want your mind to be all over the place. If you are confused, it means that you probably have a lack of mindfulness as well. And if you have a lack of mindfulness, it means that you don't really have any sense of control over your mind. The idea of mindfulness is that mindfulness is one of those spiritual faculties. And it's a spiritual faculty, it's a controlling faculty, in the sense that it enables you to be in charge of your mind. It makes you be able to be in charge of what kind of mind state, what you attend to, what you don't attend to. And in that way you have an effect, you can control whether you become angry or avoid anger and desire and all these kind of things. So mindfulness enables you to control your mind. If you haven't got any mindfulness, you're out of control. Desires and anger will arise at random. Yeah, and that, of course, is very bad. If you are on your deathbed and you're about to kind of go off into another destination and you're not really in charge of your mind, yeah, your mind is just kind of really fluctuating badly. Get the wrong impression this way or that way. Suddenly all these negative things come up. It's the last thing you want when you die. You want to die peacefully. And then, of course, the good karma will arise and will mature. And then you go off to a good destination in the future. Otherwise, you're really at the mercy of all these defilements that are kind of just waiting to come out. And especially if you have lived immorally, on top of being confused, that means that those bad actions will tend to come back to you as well. And it will have a very bad effect on you as in the dying process and also afterwards as you move on. And for that reason, you can see then, because your mind state is going to be very bad, because your consciousness is going to be dragged down, you're going to feel bad about yourself, you're going to have a low station of consciousness. This idea of station of consciousness is actually a word in the Pali Canon. Consciousness is stationed at a certain level, depending on how you live your life. Yeah, and because that station of consciousness is a drag down, it means that you had a bad level when you die, and you continue on that negative bad level in the future, and that is why you then have a bad rebirth as a consequence. Five disadvantages or perils of being immoral. And there's another nice sutta somewhere. This in the Anguttara 7s, I think, or 8s, maybe, I can't remember. And this is the general Siha. He was one of the generals at that time. And he was a general in the Vajjayan Republic, which was just north of the Ganges River. We're now just south of the Ganges River. He was north of the Ganges River. And the Buddha gives General Siha a very similar kind of discourse, talking about the advantages and disadvantages of morality and immorality, respectively. And then he says to General Siha, well, do you know that these things are right? General Siha says by himself, yes, sadhu, 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 I know that these things are right through my own practice. Because when I approach an assembly, I feel confident, yeah, because I live well. And then he says all of these things. And then he says to the very last one, but as far as rebirth is concerned, I go by faith in the Blessed One to know that that is the, that is also correct. So faith is also a factor. As far as rebirth is concerned, there's always going to have to be a degree of faith there initially in these teachings. Anyway, so that is the disadvantages of immorality. Now we have the advantages of morality, which are exactly the opposite. And householders, there are these five advantages to one of good morality, of success in morality. What are they? In the first place, through careful attention of his affairs, he gains much wealth. Okay. So again, I think it just means through being heedful, basically, that's what it really means. Through being heedful, he creates a lot of wealth. So his pile of wealth increases if he is heedful. In the second place, he gets a good reputation if he is moral and has good conduct. In the third place, whatever assembly he approaches, whether the kshatriyas, the brahmins, the householders, or the ascetics, he does so with confidence and assurance. In the fourth place, he dies unconfused. In the fifth place, after death, at the breaking up of the body, he arises in a good destination, even in a heavenly world. These are the five advantages to one of good morality and of success in morality. So there you are. Can you think of any other advantages that comes from morality? Is there anything more? Is this exhaustive, or are there further advantages? Because one of the things that is missing here, which is kind of really important for anyone who is serious about Buddhist practice, is of course that morality is the foundation stone for all Buddhist practice. Yeah, it's a foundation stone for meditation practice, for being able to watch your breath, ultimately for wisdom and for everything else. But that's missing here, because these are probably newcomers to Buddhism. You don't talk about the more profound issues. Talk about the straightforward issues that they can relate to straight away. But that, of course, is in the end, is the real reason for practicing morality, is that it is absolutely essential for the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, everybody happy with that? Makes sense? Yeah? No? Everybody thinks this seems a bit dodgy, or does it seem fine? John? Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Just that attaining wealth.
Yeah.
Actually, it would also work too, as the person becomes more moral, they wouldn't want so much wealth. So therefore, they would be coupled with it adequate, because it doesn't have to grow. It
yeah.
Actually, decrease. They'd be quite happy with a small amount.
Mm. Yeah. I think that's probably true. They probably would be more concerned about other things rather than building up wealth. That's true, huh? But sometimes, you know, you get good people who are wealthy as well. You know, it kind of often is a mixture of things. So I agree but sometimes this wealth just comes to you because you're moral. I think this is one of the things that it means here, that even if you don't want wealth, even if you don't care about it, because you are apamada, yeah, because you are heedful, it comes anyway. You can't stop it. It just flows into your bank account. Yeah. Oh, the zeros are adding towards at the end of the bank account is growing up. That's kind of a nice thought, that things just tend to happen well for good people. Yeah. It's like I'm a Buddhist monk, you know, but I'm really well looked after. I can't really complain. So it's kind of strange. I don't have any salary or anything. I still look really, really well after. That probably comes as part of that same kind of thing. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
And then also, what about just in general life? Having friends?
Yeah, you're saying that there's many different kinds, I'm just saying it for the recording, that there's many different types of wealth, and some of them are more like kind of spiritual or mental wealth rather than actually just being physically wealthy. That's true, but I think what is meant here is a physical kind of wealth. That's what's meant here. The spiritual wealth, that's already, you're already looking at things more lofty, yeah? You're looking at things that have more to do with the actual practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Here it means literally a heap of goods, yeah? You've got a nice car, a nice house, and a big bank account, that sort of stuff. Yeah, it doesn't say a big bank account here, but I think that's kind of implied, yeah. Yes?
In suttas like Singhalovada Sutta and all other places, that Buddha praises those moral people having wealth, people like Anathapindika, who spent all, spread so much of gold to get that. And Upali, Visakha, they were all very rich people, rich in wealth as such, but they built so many monasteries and they looked after the Sangha.
I think that's a very good point. And I think sometimes I hear people say, oh, you're not really interested in money, you know, so it doesn't matter. But actually, to have a lot of money has a lot of advantages. You can be, as you say, you can be incredibly generous. You can give out. I remember one person I know very well. I'm not going to say who it is because you would know straight away. But he said to me, my family has got so much money, you know, so much wealth, and it kind of came in through some kind of inheritance or something. But she doesn't really want it, doesn't have, you know, kind of not really interested in all of that. But I reminded this person that, well, actually, it's wonderful, yeah? Now you have this excellent opportunity to give it away. Isn't that a wonderful thing? If you haven't got the money, you have nothing to give away. Now you can actually just give it away. Well, yeah, that's a good point, yeah? So it's just how we think about things, yeah? So on the one hand, I think it's true, your interest in wealth is reduced. But it's still, even if you haven't got that interest, you can spend whatever you have in a very wise way. So either way, you've got a lot, it's great. If you haven't got a lot, it's still great. Win-win situation, yeah? This is the Buddhist path in a nutshell. Win-win. So, now thank you for those points. Anyone else like to say anything? No? Okay. Good. Okay. What we have is that then the Lord instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted the lay followers of Patalligama with a talk on Dhamma until far into the night. Then he dismissed them, saying, householders, the night is nearly over. Now is the time for you to do as you think fit. Very good, Lord, they said, and rising and bowing down to the Lord, they circumambulated him with the right side towards him and departed. And the Lord spent the remainder of the night in the rest house, left empty by their departure. It probably means like an empty enclosure within the rest house, probably what it actually means, but that is... That's close enough. This is again a standard kind of phrase that you see in the suttas. The idea that you kind of inspire people the Dhamma talk. Obviously, the Buddha was very, very good at this, and you see this kind of things everywhere in the suttas. So this is a kind of standard thing. You inspire them. You fire. It says, fire is kind of a. Fire them up, yeah? Delight them, instruct them. And then they're all really nice and inspired. And this is what the good Dhamma teaching should do. You read the suttas, it should really inspire you. This is one of those important factors. And then when you feel the inspiration of the Dhamma, yeah? This is so powerful when you get the inspiration right. You start to feel peaceful. And you just want to meditate afterwards. And your meditation becomes so much more powerful precisely because of that inspiration. And this is one of those great things that people often forget about the Dhamma. The Dhamma, reading the Dhamma has at least two functions, probably more. One is that you understand what is going on. The second one, I think, is that understanding kind of seeps in, yeah, over time. It becomes deeper and deeper in a sense. So you hear it many times, even though you have understood it. You allow it to become a deeper part of you over time. But the last thing about the hearing Dhamma, when you know enough, very often it's just to inspire you, yeah? To hear the Dhamma, I know this from the monastery, you listen to a talk by Ajahn Brahma, and then you go back to your kuti, and you just feel inspired, and you kind of want to meditate, and you practice in the right way. Yeah? It energizes you, it gives you those good feelings and good vibrations, so to speak. Yeah? And then it is very powerful. There is actually a sutta where the Buddha talks about this specifically. He says that you have heard enough discourses, monks. Whatever talk we have should really be about inspiring you, yeah? To make you put forth effort and energy. Talk about those fundamental things of the holy life that inspire you to practice in the right way. Yeah? So this is a very important part of Dhamma talks. Okay, and then they all leave, and the Buddha then stays overnight. And then it continues. Now, at this time, Sunida and Vasakara, the Magadhan ministers, were building a fortress or a town in Pataligama as a defense against the Vajjayans. And at that time, a multitude of thousands of devas were taking up lodging in Pataligama. And in the parts where powerful devas settled, they caused the minds of the most powerful royal officials to pick those sites for their dwellings. And where the middle and low-ranking devas settled, so too they caused the minds of the royal officials of corresponding grey to pick those sites for their dwellings. So here we have these two ministers of Magadha, Vasakara, we heard about early on already in this sutta, and he was the number one minister of King Ajatasattu, who was the king of Magadha at that time. And here we also have Sunida, which presumably is his kind of fellow ministers. And they were building the fortress, and Nagara is like a fort or a town, yeah, in Pataligama, building it up as a defense against the Vajjayans. And the Vajjayans, again, this is the republic that is north of the river Ganges, immediately north of Pataligama. And not very far from there, you have Vaisali. Vaisali was the ancient capital of the Vajjayan Republic. If you go to India today, in Vaisali, all you find are the ruins from that time. But it's still kind of marked out. The ruins are still discoverable there at the present day. And what we are really seeing here is that we're seeing kind of some of the historical records of the expansion of the Magadhan Empire. Magadha had already captured some of the neighboring states. The Anga state, which was to the east of Magadha, they had already captured Benares, Varanasi, yeah, the famous city on the river Ganges, which is still considered a holy city to the present day for the Hindus in India. And that was also part already of the Magadhan Empire. And here you can see there's some confrontation going on with the Vajjayans. So this, you can see here, almost history in action. And we know that this is roughly what happened, because later on in history, we know that the Magadhan Empire, with the capital in Pataliputra, was a massive empire over the entire north of India. It fits in with the overall view of history here. So here they're building a fortress, yeah, getting ready to kind of fight these Vajjayans, trying to hold out on the north of the river Ganges, and kind of, you know, try to sack them and sort them out. They are a democratic republic, so they obviously, maybe they think that they're going to be weak or whatever. And they have previously asked the Buddha, I don't know if you were here when we did this, they asked the Buddha about the Vajjayans, and the Buddha told them how strong they were, precisely because of that democratic structure they had. And then they kind of find crafty ways of undermining the Vajjayans so they can actually take them over later on. So this is all part of the same kind of general historical trend that we see here. And then we have this strange little passage about all these devas taking up lodging in Pataligama. Yeah? And it says that where the powerful devas settled, it says here, they caused the minds of the most powerful royal officials to pick those sides for their dwellings. And this is actually a mistranslation. That is not what it says. The partner says is that the minds of those powerful royal officials, they tended to establish the houses where those powerful devas were. The devas are not doing anything at all. They're just kind of setting up the houses there. They're not kind of causing anyone to build houses. It's just that it seems to be an automatic kind of reaction from these royal officials that they kind of move towards where the powerful devas are. The powerful hanging out with the powerful, yeah? The middling people hanging out with the middling people. The more ordinary people hanging out with the ordinary ones. Which kind of sort of makes sense because that's usually how things tend to be in this world. But did this really happen? Is this actually what happened? And this is kind of the interesting question here. Because there isn't really much support for this elsewhere in the suttas. The idea that, you know, the devas kind of dwell where powerful people dwell. They are the powerful devas are. There may be some interaction between the devas and the humans. But it doesn't seem to work exactly in this way. So I must admit, I tend to be a little, when I see this kind of thing, I wonder what is going on. And if you know the history of India again, if you look at this from a historical perspective, it opens up a different way of interpreting what this sutta is actually saying. And what we know from history again is that very soon after the Buddha's passing away, the Magadhan Empire started to expand very rapidly. And soon after the Magadhan Empire started to expand, Pataliputra became the new capital of this large Magadhan Empire as it expanded. And not long afterwards, it was a magnificent capital of this of the Magadhan Empire. So what I think is going on here is that the Parinibbana Sutta is one of the very latest suttas in the Pali Canon. It is late because part of the sutta was obviously taught, written down after the Buddha passed away, because it specifically talks about some of the events after the Buddha's passing away. So it is like a collection of facts, a collection of history that was made after the Buddha's passing. And of course, soon after the Buddha's passing, this is exactly what happened in the Magadhan history, is that Pataliputra became a magnificent capital and all of these kind of things. So I think that probably what has happened here is that some of those events that happened after the Buddha's passed away, they were kind of, the Buddhist order, the Buddhists started to realize the importance of Pataliputra, and because they understood the importance of that, they wanted to write some of that into the history of Buddhism, write it into the Mahaparinibbana Sutra. And I think this is what we are seeing here. We're seeing this later events changing how the Mahaparinibbana Sutra actually was written down. And of course, if you want to be close to powerful kings, if you want to kind of have some kind of connection between Buddhism and the secular world then was the kings more than anything else. Yeah, what do? You have to create some kind of connection. And what they are really saying here in the sutta is that the powerful people will be guarded by powerful gods. Yeah, so in other words, if you are the king of Magadha, yeah, the Buddhists are saying, well, that means that you're going to be guarded by powerful gods who have kind of settled down in this place precisely because you are here, yeah? You are powerful. The powerful deities came for this reason. And of course, for the kings, that would have been very nice. Yeah, think, oh yeah, powerful gods are guarding me. That sounds really cool. So I can kind of relax more in my palace or whatever because the gods look after me. So you can see how these things, I think this is quite a likely explanation for what is going on here, because I don't think there is much evidence elsewhere in the suttas for this kind of connection between people and the gods quite in this way. So is this true? To what extent is this true though? Is it the case that gods sometimes look after human beings? Is that possible? Is this how the world actually functions? I think it is conceivable that you know, some of these devatas may sometimes support humans because sometimes there is an overlap between these different realms. So it is perhaps possible, but I don't think it is something that one should rely on. It's not something that is important in the suttas to pray to various kinds of gods and to get their support. That is not how Buddhism works. Yeah, what you do to gain support is that you live morally, you live well, and then you support yourself in the right way. And sometimes if there are some devas around, I don't really know if this is true or not, but perhaps they will be inspired by your good conduct, and then they will support you a little bit because you are a good person. So this may well be the case. But I think what this sutta is doing, it is kind of tapping in, if you like, tapping into the Indian worldview where devas and gods are so important. You look at Hinduism today, everybody has their own private god, yeah? This is my god, and there's hundreds of different kinds of god, and you have your own little god, and you worship that god, and in return that god looks after you. And this, in a sense, is what we are seeing right here. We're seeing this interaction between the gods and the rulers in this way. So Buddhism is almost like it is using some of the prevailing ideas, and because it is compatible to Buddhism to some extent, it means that they can put that into the sutta in this way. In this way, forging a relationship between Buddhism and rulers. Yeah, everything is politics in this world, and this, I think there's probably a little bit of politics in some of these suttas as well. So this is what I think is happening here. So for this reason, I must admit, I don't take these kind of things too seriously. And I think that there are more likely, that there are reasons for why these things actually are in there. But what is also interesting about this is that, of course, the Magadhan Empire, soon a few decades after the Buddha, it was already getting quite large, and it already was very useful for the Buddhist Sangha and the Buddhist order to be close to the secular rulers. Already it was very useful. But if you go 150 years after the Buddha, that is when you had a really massive Magadhan Empire. That's when the whole of north of India was included in one empire, ruled by one extraordinarily powerful monarch, which was Ashoka. Even prior to Ashoka, those monarchs were very, very powerful, but certainly with Ashoka, they were very, very powerful. You had Ashoka's father was Bindusara, Ashoka's grandfather Chandragupta. All of those kings were extremely powerful monarchs. But of course, what is interesting is that none of those are actually mentioned in the suttas. Yeah. So none of that actually has made its way. But of course, from a Buddhist point of view, the reign of Ashoka was extremely important and very, very powerful. He was the greatest monarch in the history of India, both before and after. And it would have been very tempting for them to kind of latch onto that and incorporate that into the suttas to show the connection between the Buddha and Ashoka. Maybe the Buddha could just predict Ashoka. Yeah, the Buddha would have known, so he would predict Ashoka's arising. It would have been very natural to put that in there. And in fact, this is the kind of thing you do find. You do find in later Buddhist texts. You find the idea of the Buddha predicting the reign of Ashoka. And then you create that connection again between Ashoka and Buddhism and the Buddha himself. Yeah. And of course, that is very flattering for Ashoka, yeah, if the Buddha kind of predicted him. Also very useful for Buddhism to flatter the royalty a little bit, to get a bit more kind of support from the royalty. You can see the mutual benefit in this kind of thing, and how easy it is to kind of go down that line a little bit too much, get involved in politics. But what is so amazing is that you don't find this in the suttas. Nowhere does it talk about Ashoka. Nowhere does it talk about the Mauryan Empire, which was the name of the empire of Ashoka, at all. His father or grandfather, any of that, that's all left out. All we have is these little hints that we have here, tiny little hints that some later material was incorporated, but it would have been very soon after the Buddha. We're talking about maybe a few decades, yeah? Not more than that. Not like 100 years already after the Buddha, that already would have been outside the limit of these suttas. And what that shows us, again, it shows us that these suttas were closed to addition very, very early on. An addition such as talking a bit about the history of Ashoka would have been considered a very minor thing, probably, because it doesn't alter the doctrine, doesn't really do anything like that. And yet, it hasn't been added. It hasn't been put in there, despite the potential for kind of boosting the fortunes of Buddhism. So this is one of those things, again, that gives you a sense of confidence that these suttas have been kept intact, that they are very authentic, that they haven't really changed because they haven't succumbed to those temptations of changing them, even though it would have been politically very useful to do so sometimes. So just a little bit of history. I don't know, I find these things important and interesting because they say something about the reliability of these suttas. So, that is what I think is the meaning of that. And then we have the next paragraph, 27. And the Lord, with his divine eye surpassing that of humans, saw the thousands of devas taking up residence in Pataligama. And getting up at break of day, he said to Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, who is building a fortress in Pataligama?" "Lord Sunada and Vasakara, the Magadha ministers, are building a fortress against the Vajjayans." "Ananda, it is just as if they had taken counsel with the 33 gods. Sunada and Vasakara are building a fortress at Pataligama. I have seen with my divine eye how thousands of devas were taking up lodgings there." And then all this thing about the powerful devas setting up the lodgings, and the powerful royals, officials, putting up the lodgings in the same place, etc. Again. And then he says, "Ananda, as far as the Aryan realm extends, as far as its trade extends, this will be the chief city, Pataliputra, scattering its seeds far and wide. And Pataliputra will face three kinds of peril, from fire, from water, and from internal dissension." So here we have the Buddha then. First of all, he is saying that he has seen the same thing with his divine eye, as this kind of, just to kind of strengthen this whole idea that this is actually happening, because otherwise how would you actually know that all these devas were there? And then he says, it is as if they had taken counsel with the gods of 33. And again, usually the gods of 33 don't have such a close connection with human beings. So again, this is one of the reasons why I said that this seems to be something a little bit odd with this passage here. But anyway, and then he has this additional thing he says at the end there. He says that, "Ananda, as far as the Aryan realm extends..." Yeah, which is in Pali. Aryang Ayatanang. Yeah, so this is the kind of the spread of the noble kind of spreading out. Yeah, Ayatana is like a sphere, the noble sphere. As long as that spreads out, as far as its trades extend, this will be the chief city, Pataliputra, scattering its seeds far and wide. So here we have the Buddha making a prediction about Pataliputra. Yeah? So, first of all, you notice here how we go from Pataligama, and suddenly now it's called Pataliputra, which is kind of curious. He is in Pataliputra, and suddenly now he uses the word Pataliputra. He is in Pataligama, now he's using the word Pataliputra. And of course, Pataliputra became the name of the city later on, as it expanded, as it became a powerful capital. That's when it actually achieved or got that name later on. So here the Buddha is almost like as if he's looking into the future and even using the name of the city as it is in the future. Yeah. There are a few other suttas where the word Pataliputra is used, but in all of those suttas, the Buddha has passed away, and it's after the Buddha's time, basically, that we're looking at that time. And then there is the thing here that the Buddha is making a prediction. Yeah, this will be the chief city. And one of the things that is interesting about the suttas is that the Buddha very rarely makes any predictions about anything. There are very few predictions in the suttas. One of the very few exceptions is where the Buddha predicts that Venerable Ananda will become enlightened in this lifetime. This is one of the very, very rare predictions. And he, I think, is basically to give Ananda a sense of ease and kind of, he can relax a little bit because he's getting very concerned about the Buddha passing away or something like that, I think it is. So that kind of fits the context very well. But here, the Buddha is kind of making a prediction without necessarily any real reason for doing so. And using the future name of Pataliputra instead of Pataligama, which is actually where they are. And again, I think that what is happening here is that I doubt very much that the Buddha would have made these kind of predictions. There is one sutta actually where the Buddha talks about knowing the past and knowing the future. And he says, knowing the past, the way to do that is to recall your past lives. Knowing the future, the way to do that is to understand the laws of karma. Yeah, by understanding the laws of karma, you can have an understanding of the future. So that's how the Buddha kind of defines knowing the future and the past. And this kind of thing is not the way normally the Buddha operates. Would it have been possible for the Buddha to see this? Maybe, I don't know, it's very hard to say. There are certain things that are within the realm of possibility. Other things may just be impossible because it's too complex or whatever. But whatever it is out of character. So I think, again, what is happening here is that later on Pataliputra became very famous. The Mahaparinibbana Sutta hadn't been compiled yet fully, so this then kind of made its way into the Mahaparinibbana Sutta as a prediction of the Buddha. Maybe somebody thought they had heard the Buddha make this prediction, and so it was added on that basis. Or maybe they thought it was obvious that the Buddha would have known this anyway, so it couldn't hurt to put it in there. Whatever it is, whatever the reason is, that is the way I would tend to look at this. And this is how these predictions come in there. And again, the benefit of this is that you tie the secular power into Buddhism. Yeah, and the glory of Buddhism glorifies the secular power, and the secular power then helps to support the Buddhist teachings at the same time. Very convenient, yeah. But a little bit of politics, and this is what is always so dangerous. It's so easy to fall prey to kind of politics and these things. This is always one of the great dangers in any kind of spiritual teaching, I think. One of the great things about being in Australia, there's not much chance of, you know, us being involved in politics. That's really probably one of the great benefits. Otherwise, Ajahn Brahm might have been prime minister or something already, because this is what often happens if you become famous. Actually, I don't think so. I think Ajahn Brahm would have been able to not withstand that. But it's actually nice sometimes to live in a society where the temptation just can't really arise, because you are really on the outskirts, you are a very small minority group in a society like Australia, which actually has a lot of benefits, I think. And then he says here that scattering its seeds far and wide. And again, this is one of those mistranslations. What it means, it will be a center of commerce. That is actually the meaning of that expression. And there are some problems with the text. And then the Buddha says it will face three dangers, from fire, from water, and from internal dissension. So from fire, it was a wooden city. Things were built in wood, so that's not too surprising. From water, it was on the edge of the river Ganges, which was prone to flooding all the time. So that wasn't very difficult to guess either. And then internal dissension, which I guess is one of the standard things. Mitta Beda, which means like the breaking up of friendships, is what actually this is really referring to there. So that is the Buddha's prediction about Pataliputra, and my personal interpretation of that. I'm sure there will be many people who disagree, but that is the way I look at that. Yes, Wayne. Yeah.
Powerful data.
That was exactly my point. He was talking about the Tabatingsa devas, yeah, and they're not earthbound devas. So I didn't go into detail because they're not earthbound. That doesn't make any sense, that connection at all. It is very strange. Yeah.
My thought was whether the Chinese actually back up has a change for this, whether it's early enough to capture the split. So it might be different than what the
I have an alternative version of the sutta, which is the Sanskrit version, and the Sanskrit version is very, very similar actually to the Pali in that context. But,
Our last point was that in the Ratna Sutta, I think Lord Buddha spoke to Ananda about asking the devas to help, like the humans pay respect to you by morning and by night.
Yeah. That's not in the Ratna Sutta. I think that's probably the background story. Yeah, I think that's in the background story of the Ratna Sutta, not in the Sutta itself. And I mean, it's something that I should have maybe talked about a bit more, because this is something you see is very, very quite prominent in the Buddhist world. You know, wherever all Buddhist countries, pretty much, there's many very common for people to have like a small shrine in the gardens. For example, you see it in Thailand. I think you see it in most Buddhist countries. Obviously not all people, but it's quite common. And then they often put out food or something for the ghosts and for the spirits or for the deities even there. And the idea is then to precisely this kind of worship that you see here. It can be many kinds of worship. It can be deities, but it can also be departed ancestors, etc. as well, that you, in those cases, you actually have, you know, you support in that way. So it is a very common thing. Indeed. We were just reading out the other sutta, and we were reading out another sutta the other day last week, where it says that the only beings you can really support through generosity and things are actually the papers, yeah? So the devas, they might kind of feel happy you're offering something to them, but in the suttas, what the devas are really happy about is when they see human beings being moral. That's what they're really happy about. Not that you give them an offering, because when they see that you're being moral, they say, yeah, okay, good, then you might get reborn in the devaloka, and we will kind of welcome you in. It's often interesting, because in Buddhism, heavenly realm too, you have wars, right? So you go to heaven and you have wars up there. You know, in the Tavatingsa heaven, yeah, according to the suttas, you still have the war between the asuras and the devas. So the devas are very happy when they see that human beings are practicing well, because then you will get reborn among the devas. You will have more people to overpower the asuras in fighting. It sounds a bit like the kind of the Viking idea of heaven, yeah? When you go to heaven as a Viking, you go to Valhalla, and you fight and drink, and then when you die in fight, you realize again, you continue the fighting afterwards. So maybe there's a connection there. Maybe there's a connection between the Vikings and the ancient Indians. I wonder. Anyway, for further research. Let's continue a little bit longer. Let's to the end of this particular section. Then Sunida and Vasakara called on the Lord, and having exchanged courtesies, stood to one side and said, "May the Reverend Gotama accept a meal from us tomorrow with his order of monks." And the Lord consented by silence. Understanding his consent, Sunida and Vasakara went home, and there had a fine meal of hard and soft food prepared. Hard and soft food just means various kinds of foods. It is a bit uncertain exactly what it means. When it was ready, they reported to the Lord, "Reverend Gotama, the meal is ready." Then the Lord, having dressed in the morning, took his robe and bowl, went with the order of monks to the residence of Sunida and Vasakara, and sat down on the prepared seat. Then Sunida and Vasakara served the Buddha and his order of monks with choice, soft and hard foods until they were satisfied. And when the Lord took his hand away from the bowl, they sat down on a low stool to one side. And as they sat there, the Lord thanked them with these verses. In whatever realm the wise man makes his home, he should feed the virtuous leaders of the holy life. whatever devas who are there who report this offering, they will pay homage, pay him respect and honor for this. They tremble for him as a mother for her son, and he for whom the devas tremble is ever happy. It's not a very good translation. I will read you an alternative one, which is far better. In that place where he makes his dwelling, having entertained the wise and virtuous here, the restrained who live the spiritual life, he should dedicate gifts of merit to those divinities who were in that place. Honored, they pay honor. Revered, they revere him. Thereafter, they have compassion on him as a mother on her own son. A man whom the divinities have compassion on always sees what is auspicious. It's quite different, isn't it? So it is not, I think the Maurice Wall translation there can be probably be improved upon a little bit. But again, the idea that the divinities will look after you, yeah, is very strong here and very powerfully expressed and kind of feeds into the Indian ideals of that particular time. And when they are respected and revered, they look after you, and then they have compassion for you, just like a mother for her own son. That is kind of the idea here. So again, this connection between devas and humans. Then the Lord rose from his seat and took his departure. Sunida and Vasakara follow closely behind the Lord, saying, "Whichever gate the ascetic Gotama goes out by today, that shall be called the Gotama Gate, and whichever ford he uses to cross the Ganges, that shall be called the Gotama Ford." And so the gate by which the Lord went out was called the Gotama Gate. And then, again, you wonder why that is in there, and maybe the reason is that later on in Pataliputra there was a gate called Gotama Gate, and maybe people was wondering why it was there, and so maybe this was then put in the sutta just to kind of make that connection perhaps. I don't know, just a wild speculation really here. And then the Lord came to the river Ganges, and just then the river was so full that a crow could drink out of it. And some people were looking for a boat, and some were looking for a raft, and some were binding together a raft of reeds to get to the other side. But the Lord, as swiftly as a strong man might stretch out his flexed arm or flex it again, vanished from this side of the Ganges and reappeared with his order of monks on the other side. And the Lord saw those people who were looking for a boat, looking for a raft, and binding together a raft of reeds to get to the other side. And seeing their intentions, he uttered this verse on the spot. When they want to cross the sea, the lake or pond, people make a bridge or raft. The wise have crossed already. So here we have one of these kind of slightly miraculous things, or supernormal events, where the Buddha suddenly appears, is on one side, and then suddenly he reappears on the other side with the order of monks, in this particular case, the river Ganges. And again, it's interesting. Did this really happen? Is this likely to have happened in this way? One question is whether the Buddha is capable of doing it. Another question is whether it actually did happen in this way. And one of the things that you always see in the suttas, when you compare the various versions, you know, the Pali with the Chinese or whatever, it's very rare to find the Buddha displaying any kind of supernormal power in this way. It doesn't really happen anywhere. And wherever it happens, there is often discrepancies between the different versions of the suttas. And this fits with the Buddha's outlook about supernormal powers. I don't know if you... Many of you may be aware of the Buddha's statement about supernormal powers. He talks about this in the Kevada Sutta, which is also in the Digha Nikaya number 11. And there he says that he is humiliated and disgusted and detests supernormal powers. Yeah, it's a very kind of strong statement about supernormal powers. And then he explains why, and the reason why he says is that what has happened is that a person from the village, this was actually in Nalanda, where the Buddha has just been before on some other occasion, the Buddha is there, and then the lay people come to the Buddha, and they say to the Buddha, please display some supernormal powers. We want to see supernormal powers. We want to see monks flying through the earth and sinking into the ground and walking into mountains and that kind of stuff. And the Buddha replies to, and if you do that, people will gain more confidence. Yeah, and that is when the Buddha replies, I detest these things, I abhor them, this is not useful. And then he says the reason is because if we display these kind of things, then those people who already have faith, they will say, wow, isn't it marvelous, isn't it astonishing, the supernormal powers of these venerable monks and the Buddha is just absolutely marvelous. But those who don't have faith, they will just dismiss it as some kind of magic trick. Yeah, and that is basically how things work in the world. So the Buddha wasn't very keen on supernormal powers, and he wasn't keen, certainly, on displaying them in public. And there is a rule for monastics that displaying a supernormal power is actually an offense. Yeah, and the Buddha came down quite strongly on a monk who did just that, according to one of the Vinaya stories. So the Buddha doesn't do this. And for this reason, I think that this whole passage, again, is very likely to be probably a kind of slight exaggeration of what actually happened. People couldn't really remember what happened, yeah? And when you can't remember, then it's easy to get things slightly the wrong way around. If you compare what the Pali has with what the Sanskrit version has, I was just referring to the Sanskrit version before. According to the Sanskrit version, the Buddha got across in this way by disappearing on one side and reappearing on the other one, whereas all the monks, they swam across. That is what Sanskrit says. Here it says the Buddha disappeared and reappeared, and so did all the monks. So already there is a discrepancy there. Yeah, so you can see how there are these problems sometimes in the various versions of this particular sutta. So again, I think it's more likely that this didn't happen in this particular way. And then the Buddha has this verse, of course, and this verse has, of course, some additional meaning, and I think this is where this whole idea of crossing over and by disappearing and reappearing kind of probably is like an expansion of this verse, perhaps, where it says that those who want to cross over, they make all of these bridges and rafts and all this kind of stuff, but the wise have crossed already. The idea here seems to be, just before you have all the people looking for boats, looking for rafts, trying to cross over the river, searching for a way, trying to find a way out of suffering, trying to find a way crossing samsara. But the wise, the Buddha, they have already crossed, they've already found the path across. So just the way of kind of expressing the Buddha's awakening, I think this is what that is really meant there. And whereas all other people are still searching for this way, kind of slightly lost, and not finding the way across the flood of existence, the flood of samsara orga, the orga of existence, that I think is probably what this is referring to. So, that is the first part of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Anyone wants to add any comments to this? Eddie? Yeah. Microphone is coming. Yeah.
Ajahn Brahmali, going back to the earlier part, you mentioned about the devas. Yeah. My understanding is, we human beings, we are in the fifth realm. Those devas in the sixth, seventh and eighth realms, they are near us, They can come to help us human beings, The 33 gods, I think they are in the seventh realm, If you refer to the animal realm, We can see animals around, So perhaps it's maybe the sixth, seventh, eighth realm, It's a different dimension, somewhere very close to us, My understanding is they can come to help human beings.
Yeah, I think maybe that's correct. I think that may be correct. I'm just not sure if it works quite the way that is expressed here in this particular sutta. But
I know what you mean.
I think there may be a connection. I mean, it's possible in your meditation practice. I know many people who say that they have done this and experienced the presence of devas through meditation practice. So these things, I think these things probably are, you know, exist and they are real. But exactly how the connection happens is maybe not quite this way. That's all. Yeah. So sure. Yeah.
Thank
Very
you.
Good. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Everybody else happy? Yeah. Okay. You want to say something? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, internet. Okay, sure. I forgot about the internet. Okay, good. Yeah. Put this to one side. Yeah, thanks. Oi, it disappeared. Where did it disappear to? I must have pressed something bad. There it is. Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah. Okay, so first of all, we have from Sue in Malaysia. Please advise how we should use the teachings and wisdom in handling unfortunate legal disputes in the fate of being wrongly accused. Okay, so what do we do when we are wrongly accused of things? And the answer is that when you are wrongly accused, the first thing to do is not to retaliate, yeah, or to do anything silly, or to kind of lose your sense of morality because somebody else is doing something wrong. Yeah. So what do you do rather than doing anything moral? You just defend yourself in an appropriate manner, telling the truth, telling the way things actually are, and defending yourself in the right way. Yeah. And usually, if you have a sense of honor and you do things in the right way, and normally things will turn out for the good as a consequence of that. So you just do what is right, do what is appropriate. And remember that life is often like this. Yes, we often get accused of wrong things. Ajahn Brahm has been accused of some terrible things. And of course, Ajahn Brahm is one of the kind of more purer human beings you can find, and still we get accused of bad things. So this is kind of part and parcel of what it means to be a human being, that these things happen to us. So really, you shouldn't be too surprised that this is happening. Very often, one of the most skillful ways of using these kind of difficult situations is to understand them as a Dhamma lesson. It's a lesson in the nature of samsara, a lesson in the nature of existence. This is the way things are, yeah? Things are sometimes very difficult. We tend to think that something has gone wrong because we get wrongfully accused, but actually, probably nothing has gone wrong at all. It's probably just the way that things have to be sometimes. Don't think of it as bad karma, don't think of it as anything like that. It's just the nature of being a human being that these things happen. And what it teaches you, this is the nature of samsara, and once you understand that, it helps you to turn away from samsara a little bit. It becomes more terrible, more unsatisfactory, more don't really want to be here anymore if this is the way it is. Yeah? So think about it like that, then it becomes very useful. And it turns you towards the Dhamma instead. It turns you towards a place where it is actually possible to find some real refuge. Rather than having refuge in false things, which is really what most people have, we all have, unless you have some insight into the Dhamma, you place your refuge in the right place. And as you do that, and you kind of build up your own inner good qualities, next time you have a legal case, yeah? Because there will be a next time, yeah? I'm sorry to say that, but there always is a next time. Any kind of misfortune we have, that misfortune will tend to come back again. Divorces, losing your job, people dying, it always comes back. You can't avoid these things. But next time you have a legal case, you will still be unhappy about it, but you will be able to tackle it far better because you have built up your mind and you have built up your inner qualities instead. So make sure you don't do anything immoral, because then you're dragging yourself down, making it even more difficult. Fight the legal case righteously in a good way. Do what you have to do. And then when you do that, you are building up long-term success for yourself. Think long-term. When you think long-term, you will know what is right. Don't think short-term. Think about when the legal case is finished. Because one day it will be finished. Yeah? What then? And if you do something bad now, you will feel bad at that particular point. Life always carries on somehow. And that is what you have to think about. That is what really matters. Okay. Good luck. It is always difficult and unfortunate when these things happen. But if you use it wisely, then you can grow so much in the Dhamma just by using these difficult situations in a wise way. Okay. Charlie from Adelaide, in regard to the importance of being mindful at the time of death, how does this work for those suffering with dementia and Alzheimer's? I think that what happens with those who have have lost a lot of their ability to be aware in this way, what happens to them is that when you approach death, the mindfulness returns again. This is actually one of those very interesting things. I read a book a while ago called Irreducible Mind, and it was about all kind of strange mental phenomena that are not really explicable according to the modern outlook, which is called like the materialist or physicalist outlook on the world. And what they said in there was that many people, apparently, when they come very close to death, like the last 10, 15 minutes before they die, when they have Alzheimer's, they have dementia, they actually come out of that and they start recognizing people again. It's like you haven't recognized your family members, you haven't recognized anyone for years, for a long, long time, sometimes for decades even, perhaps. And suddenly you emerge from that and you become completely lucid the last 10 minutes before you die. Son, mother, father, whoever it is, probably not mother and father, but spouse or whatever it is. And you recognize people. And of course that is completely inexplicable from the ordinary medical point of view, where the mind is just a product of brain functioning. If the brain is down, the mind shouldn't be able to have this kind of lucid experiences. So what happens as you die is that the mind starts to withdraw from the physical aspects of the body, so it is released slightly from that, and then the dementia disappears at the same time, because the dementia is a brain problem, not a mind problem. The Alzheimer is a brain problem, not a mind problem. Clarity returns. So if you have lived your life well prior to the time you have Alzheimer's, then that morality helps you to establish mindfulness at that time, as you are dying, as you are in the process of dying. So mindfulness still works, and it works on all the things that you did before you got that dementia, before you got those problems. A lot of the things in the world are physical causes, but the mind, even things like, sometimes all kind of mental problems that we have may have physical causes. As soon as you withdraw from that physical body, the mind is freed from those problems. Okay, this is from Indira in Sri Lanka. Hello, Indira. Buddha says that the first peril of being not heedful is your properties are not protected. But immoral people, good at protecting the property immorally, also aren't they. They are good at protecting the property immorally also, aren't they? Sometimes they are. Sometimes immoral people probably are quite good at protecting the property. Can be the case. Sometimes you might have immoral people who actually acquire property through immoral means. That is obviously one very common thing. But I think probably the Buddha is probably right that protection happens better for those people who are really heedful and careful, because you have a right outlook. Your outlook is more to do with the way the world actually is. You are living morally because you know that's the long-term happiness. And because your outlook is right, you're more likely to make the right decisions also in case of your property. One of the things I think what happens is if you acquire things in an immoral way, is that you feel that you are not a rightful owner of that property. You don't feel it's really yours because you have acquired it in the wrong way. And if you feel it is not really yours, it is quite likely that you will be a little bit less scrupulous or careful in looking after it, because it doesn't really feel that it was yours in the first place. So maybe you are kind of a bit more, a bit more careless in a sense in your outlook. And one of the suttas that is very interesting talks about similar kind of issues, is where the Buddha says that when we are generous, the most powerful kind of generosity is with the things that we have acquired rightfully, righteously, in a good way. Yeah, so if you have worked really hard and you have lived your life really well, and all the property that you have, you really have earned that property through living well, living rightfully, then you feel that it really belongs to you. It is your rightful property because you've done the right thing. And the Buddha says that kind of property is what is very powerful to give away. Very powerful to be generous with those things that you have rightfully earned, because you really feel it is yours to give away. This is my stuff. I'm willingly letting go of what is already mine. If it doesn't really feel like it's yours, then of course, you know, you don't have the same feeling of relinquishing things. And the power of that act of generosity will not be the same as a consequence. It's interesting. It shows, I think, the power of something rightfully earned, rightfully owned, is very powerful and very useful, both in the moral sphere, in the sphere of generosity, and also many other places. But you are probably right, there are always some exceptions to these rules. Yeah, there's always somebody, some scallywag somewhere who kind of earns things in a kind of dodgy way, and then guards it and kind of holds on to it or whatever, and then of course it deludes other people into thinking that this is a good way of acquiring property. That is the most dangerous thing, I think. But I think in the overall picture, I'm sure the Buddha is right about this, that if you are immoral, you tend to lose your property more quickly. If you are immoral, you cannot enjoy the property that you have as much. If you are immoral, your generosity even isn't as powerful, because you don't really feel like you're owning these things. So we need to be very careful and very wise. You don't need to be careful not to kind of just follow the ordinary stream of people and the way they think about these things. Okay, anyone else? Anybody happy? Yeah, okay, excellent. So let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.